But now I want you to keep it tuned to this program, Dave's Gone By, because we'll be talking to the son of a minor figure in music history, but he's certainly a rather important footnote. His name was Dickie Goodman, and without him, it's hard to tell whether we would have quite the level of mashups and sampling that we do in our music today. We'll let John Goodman, the son of Dickie Goodman, explain all that. But first, let's hear a bit of what Dickie Goodman did 1956. It's almost 60 years ago when he did this hit record called The Flying Saucer, all about, well, you'll hear it for yourself. Here's Dickie Goodman.
Hi, this is John Goodman, and you're listening to Dickie Goodman with Dave, host of Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Saturday morning. You know, nowadays, artists, musical artists, think nothing of mashups or of taking snippets or even one beat or a drum track or any little piece of a song and then layering that into another song, then layering 12 other things from other sources into that song, and it creates a new entity. Well, that wasn't quite so common 5 or 6 decades back when Dickie Goodman, a young Brooklyn-born boy, thought, what might be funny is if we create this comedy record, this novelty idea of having an interviewer talk about something or interview people, but instead of the answers that people would give, we're going to lay in little snippets of the hit pop songs of the day. Not only was it a clever idea, it became this huge hit. It basically made his career, and something that he would keep doing for years and years after that, and eventually on some level did lead to the mashing up and the breaking in and the sampling that we have today. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, and then to share the process of that with us, as well as the life of the late Dickie Goodman, is Dickie Goodman's son, who is going strong, who has put together not only a biography of his dad, which is also kind of an autobiography of himself and his relationship with Dickie Goodman, but he's also got a new CD of his dad's work, basically a best-of collection, 27 tracks on Dickie Goodman, Long Live the King, that's from Rock Beat Records, and Long Live John Goodman, who's on the telephone with us right now. Hello, John?
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, anytime. I should mention that the 27th track on your CD is actually composed or created by you with a bit of your father in there, too. So it's really 26 tracks plus one, to be fair.
Yeah, well, I had to throw in that little duet at the end, you know, if Natalie Cole can have a duet with her dad, Nat King Cole, you could certainly do it with Dickie Goodman.
Absolutely. Now I don't even know where to start with you, but I guess we kind of do have to start from the beginning. There's this idea of your dad was just a young New York-y guy, and how did he go from that to creating the world's most famous, not really the first, but the most famous break-in sampling record?
He was trying to break in to the music business as a songwriter. And he had a little bit of success with that, writing songs that got picked up. I mean, he did some stuff, and they actually continued throughout his career. So whether it was the Del Vikings, the Sonnets, the Nutmegs, and stuff like that in the 50s, and then even in later years with Del Shannon and other famous artists.
Oh. I don't mean to break in here. Sorry, I'll be doing that pun a lot during this interview. But what song did he do for, did he write for Del Shannon?
I'd have to look it up.
Oh, okay. Cool. It also struck me sort of weird because I think both of them came to sort of the same bad end, which we'll get to later. So it's just a little strange to hear that name come out of there.
Oh, he was connected with the number thing. He wrote, he was Frankie Sardo's producer, wrote songs for him. Frankie Sardo was one of the survivors from the Winter Dance Party of 59. Some people might not know that name today because it wasn't one of the names announced. Hey, we hear these famous people.
Wait, Bill Haley didn't go down in the plane.
Buddy Holly and
Big Bopper,
Richie Valens.
And Richie Valens, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
He was involved with a lot of people in the music industry like that.
Well, okay, I'm sorry to interrupt and kind of get you off track there. Your father, Dickie Goodman, is writing songs for other artists for these bands. Was your dad in the Brill Building? Was he one of those people?
He would hang out at a local soda fountain pharmacy place and then just go into the Brill Building and knock on doors with his songs. That's how he bumped into Bill Buchanan, was doing the same thing. So Bill Buchanan had a great radio voice. And the inspiration for the Flying Saucer was that Dickie Goodman was raised during America's golden radio days as a child. Families then were gathered around a radio rather than the television. And so they were listening to radio shows. So it was kind of like the reality show. And I think when he made the Flying Saucer, that's what inspired him was to make a show, a little, you know, radio show.
Yeah. One thing I didn't realize until starting to research Dickie Goodman and your stuff was that, Billy Jones and Ernest Hare, the so-called Happiness Boys, did have a novelty record. They were comedian people back, I guess, in the 20s, where it was kind of making fun of spinning the radio dial. And so they'd be talking, and then you'd hear radio noise and then a snippet of a radio thing. So it had been kind of done before in a different way, this kind of break-in mashup sort of record. But again, did your dad ever tell you that there was this moment of inspiration of like, if I take my question and cut a song lyric in there, wow. I mean, did he ever tell you of that moment?
Well, it was more of a synchronicity of things. For example, back in these days, if you ask somebody to name the most famous newscaster, well, you can't. There's 900 of them. But back then, there would be one most famous newscaster, so he could mimic that guy for the record. Also, with popular culture, he was influenced with what was going on back then with the flying saucer sightings.
Sure.
That everybody was seeing. And then these days, there are some more possible logical reasons for the flying saucer sightings as being, you know, Area 51, and we were working on new technology or whatever, but back then it would be in the news that there were flying saucers over the White House or flying saucers everywhere back then. So he was inspired by that as well. It was a synchronicity of a number of things that gave him the idea.
Yeah, but I mean, that still all sounds like the impetus and the inspiration for a comedy sketch. I'm just trying to get that moment when it turned into something else, into, wow.
I mean, these days, you've got the comedy sketches are innumerable. You've got the late-night talk show hosts that could talk about anything they want to with no restrictions. And you know, you've got, like, your Saturday Night Live. And,
sure.
And back then, they just didn't have that. We had a famous president that no one knew was in a wheelchair because the journalist agreed to only show him from, you know, the upper torso up. You know, it was a lot, much of a different era, and he came out with this record that was funny and made fun of stuff, but there's social commentary hidden within it.
Can I ask, did he press the record himself on his own dime, and then, with Buchanan, I guess, and then bring it to various radio stations, to INS or wherever, or how did it go from being some really cool thing that he wanted to play for somebody to getting on the radio, getting Alan Freed and all that?
All he had was a tape, and you know, that's part of what he did. That was pretty amazing. Today, you can do this stuff on your home computer. The technology's so advanced, and he literally had to splice tape together with a razor blade, and so he shot the tape around. And again, back in those days, he was able to literally just walk right in, no security guards to stop him or whatever. He was able to walk right into the largest radio station on Earth and say, here, play this. So Alan Freed liked it and played it. And then the next guy who was just as famous as him went on to play it, and it just became an overnight hit.
And then was it Roulette Records that picked it up, or how did it again go?
After that, went after, you know, it's playing on the air, he continued shopping it, and he was sitting in George Goldner, the producer at Roulette's office, and then one of the salesmen came bursting in asking if anybody had heard about this flying saucer thing that's on the radio. So they went ahead and gave him the deal, the Roulette Records.
There you go. Now, it became obviously this huge hit, this phenomenon. It was one of those cultural touchstones of 1956. But it also caused a bit of trouble because, well, artists, I guess, started hearing 3 seconds of their song on the radio in this tune. They weren't getting paid for it. And so somebody started suing somebody, and that snowballed. What were the legal ramifications of the Flying Saucer Part 1 and 2?
Yeah, well, he was basically sued by 17 labels. He was also sued by labels who were angry that they weren't included on the record. He was also sued by a label that was for their expenses to be, that due to the record, a record they were no longer selling, and people hearing the sample and requesting it on radio stations and so on, they were forced to re-release their record. He was also sued by Whitman's Chocolates for using their trademark term sampler. So, there was an article in Time magazine that said if you're not on Saucer, you're nowhere. So, that all just sort of worked itself out, really, and he was free to continue.
There was a deal, so did he end up having to pay anybody?
There's already systems in place, let's just say, to pay for using. It's just like if Pat Boone sings Little Richard's Tutti Frutti, that's a cover version, and there's already a system in place to be able to pay for the use of other people's music.
Right, well, that's the copyright and ASCAP and BMI and things like that, but I thought for parody, wouldn't it be fair game if it was less than 30 seconds, or is that a much, much later rule?
They paid for what's called mechanicals, basically, like the publishing rights when you use someone else's song. That was there. What caused the hoopla mostly was that he just did it. He didn't know all of that, have the wherewithal for all of that. He just made this record that all of a sudden was a hit. And so that all had to be done after the fact.
But when it was all said and done, he came out very, very well ahead.
Well, the thing is, they were suing him for copyright infringement, and the judge said it's not, because he created a new work. That his record, if you listen to it, it's obviously not just a compilation of other people's songs. It's a whole new...
Right, and there's no segment of a song that's longer than, like, 3 or 4 seconds in that.
Hi, this is John Goodman, and you're listening to Dickie Goodman with Dave, host of Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
So... that was all in 1956, and then he even did the whole legal thing in Buchanan and Goodman on trial. By 57, I guess he knew, at that point, a couple of things. He knew, okay, if I go and make one of these, I'll have to pay for the royalties beforehand, fine. And he keeps making these kinds of records for years to come, right?
He just made them. Even in the rare instance where he had the luxury of a big record company being behind it that would do all the clearance and that sort of thing, he'd make it anyway. Years later, I was talking to Irv Lichtman, the editor of Billboard magazine, when I was trying to get my father's records out on CD and get the word out. And Irv told me that he was the one who actually did the clearance for Mr. Jaws in 1975. And so even in that case, Irv was saying that, you know, there were two artists that didn't want to be on there at all, Glenn Campbell and Olivia Newton-John. And my father said, that's okay, just do it anyway. We could take them off later.
And did they stay?
They're not on the album version, let's put it.
Okay. Why would Glenn Campbell and Olivia Newton-John not want to be a... who knows?
The vast majority of your artists and even companies would see the value of it because it didn't hurt them. There were many, many documented instances where his records literally spurred on the other records. There were stations in the 50s that wouldn't play Elvis because it was race music, but because they were playing the Flying Saucer and it was a hit, and their station was being besieged by requests not just to play the Flying Saucer again, but hey, I want to hear that Elvis guy. If you tell people that story, they'll be, yeah, come on, give me a break. But that's the reality of it. I mean, those stations were playing
So almost as an unintentional side note, he ended up breaking some barriers in radio for artists of color.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, just the whole freedom of speech kind of thing was generated by his records that, you know, otherwise you would just pass it off as something trivial.
I remember reading or hearing a Weird Al Yankovic interview, and Weird Al is very careful. You know, he'll do a parody. I'm sure it comes to him. He thinks of it. He writes it. And then he always clears it. He goes and approaches the artist and says, okay, is it all right if I do this? And there was only one time, I forget who it was, it's probably pretty easy to look up, where an artist just said, nope, don't want you making fun of my stuff. Everybody else is honored, because parody is the sincerest form of flattery or something like that. But we're talking with John Goodman, the son of the late Dickie Goodman. I also want to talk a little bit about the mechanics of what your dad did for these records. How long, as you said, since he was dealing with reel-to-reel tape, a razor blade, and probably some, you know, sticky cement stuff like I used to do when I was in NYU film school 100 years ago, how long would it take him to put together a 2.5-minute mashup record?
I was at least there for records he did in later years where, oddly enough, they're still working with tape. I mean, even at the point in 75 where they had a mixing board in the studio, they're still working with reel-to-reel tape.
Oh, sure.
So he'd go into the studio and just stay there till it was done, you know, so whether it was 24 hours straight or whatever it was. And he was an absolute perfectionist with his stuff back then, which is important because these days we've come to expect perfection. You know, just 20 years ago, there were lots of B-movies. Now there's no B-movies because all movies are perfect because of CGI. So this perfection that we've come to expect, he was doing that, you know, handmade with tape.
Wow. Yes. Would you say that he was had a manic personality then, if you're saying that he would just work like for 24 hours instead of parceling out over the course of 3 or 4 days, going to the studio, working a bit, then not? Did he have huge highs and then crash? Was that the sort of person he was?
He was definitely manic, compulsive, take all those adjectives and put them together.
Okay, you just did. Manic, compulsive, and that spurred on his creativity. While he was still doing, I mean, year after year, all the cut-up songs and the break-in songs, after sort of the Brill Building era, what was he doing when he wasn't doing those? Was he still writing? Was he producing other people?
Yeah, he produced other acts. He was always doing something that was odd or unique. I mean, when he went to work at the 20th Century Fox Record Company, and he was there while when Kennedy was assassinated. So the very day that Kennedy was assassinated, he put together an album of Kennedy's speeches, and it was a hit. Whatever it was at the time, he had a deal with a major marketing company in New York where they were going to change from glass bottles to tin cans for soda.
Yeah.
So he got a group that called them the Glass Bottle and wrote songs for them, and they had hits.
See, what I'm also trying to get at is he had this career that wasn't, not that there's anything wrong. I mean, his legacy will be that he was this break-in novelty record king, but that he had a career in different facets going for a couple of decades, and even had, as you said, in 1975, Mr. Jaws was his second biggest hit, and that was already like 14, 15 years after Flying Saucer.
Yeah, nearly 20 years later. 19 years later.
Almost 20 years later, exactly.
Basically number one hit, because that was his thing too. You had the different charts to go by in those days, and he would always just ignore Billboard because Billboard would have him at 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever. But he's in Cashbox, he'd be number one. In Record World, he'd be number one. And they had Your Hit Parade and Variety and just all of these other music charts. I mean, in his day, they would call diners and ask them what's getting played on your jukebox. You know, that's how they got the statistics, where these days the song's embedded with a microchip so they could track you at home, you know, where you're playing the record and how many times you play it. Hi, this is John Goodman, and you're listening to Dickie Goodman with Dave, host of Dave's Gone. Gone By on UNC Radio.
I've heard you on other interviews where you say that whereas Mr. Jaws was almost like this renewal for his career, by the time he got to 1982 and he wanted to go back to the same well with Hey E.T., it just didn't quite happen. I mean, I remember hearing that on Dr. Demento.
That was, he could have had that third comeback, if you want to call it that. He just got a tough break because he was an indie, you know, before they coined the term indie. You had the KET out there. It bubbled under on Billboard because it was getting the airplay, but he ran out of money to make the records to refill the record stores.
Oh.
Yeah.
So at that point, was he doing other work? Was he still with...
Right, I mean, right at that moment, he was relying on that record to give him his big comeback. He had a hit in the making, and because he was an indie, it didn't have, like, a huge label behind him to pump money into it. It bubbled under.
What kind of father was Dickie Goodman?
Well, other kids would, you know, their dad would take them to baseball games, and... My dad took me to the racetrack.
Okay.
And so, you know, their kids would get a baseball autographed, and I'd get the Racing Forum autographed by a top jockey. Or other kids were being tucked into bed at bedtime, and I was in the studio with my father in San Diego after driving for hours in the fog up all night recording a new record. Oh. I was like a little sidekick because I was... a good little tag-along. I'd have a little radio, a tape player radio to record little songs he heard on the radio for him, to come up with one-liners, and just was there.
Well, that sounds like a fun part of actually, it doesn't sound bad at all. Was your dad a heavy gambler, or did he just like to spend the day at the track?
Oh, yeah. He was definitely a heavy gambler with the horse races, no doubt.
Uh-huh. Okay, and so that also left him in kind of a bad way towards those middle 1980s. I mean, and also, I guess there was a divorce in there. What was it like growing up?
There's several divorces in there. Several divorces and several girlfriends. To this day, I've got ex-girlfriends of his telling me that they own his entire music catalog because he signed it over to them for a one-night stand, you know, or...
greater men have done the same, I'm telling you. But how long was your dad married to your mom?
As long as it lasted. What I used to say was he'd have a hit record, he'd get a new wife, buy a new Cadillac, and move to a new place. And so that's pretty much how that one went. You know, he got Mr. Jaws, so he got a white Cadillac with a chrome silver lady hood ornament and an orange leather roof and a 50-foot cable antenna, and we drove from New York to L.A.
So did he always have custody of you, or did you wind up elsewhere?
It was up to me.
Oh.
Whoever I could, I had the most patience for at the time, that's who I would stay with.
And the judges were...
My mom was in the music business, too, a singer, and... And so I went back and forth.
Who was your mom?
Well, her stage name was Susan Smith. So she was one of those almost famous. She didn't quite achieve his success.
Is she still with us? Did she?
Yeah, she's still around today.
Oh, far out. And she doesn't still sing, I assume, but she's still...
Just for me.
Do you still live in New York? Because your dad was a Brooklyn-born boy. Were you Brooklyn also?
I almost can't identify with any one place just because it was almost like being an Army grad where I traveled the entire country with him wherever he went.
When you're not dealing with your dad's legacy, with his recordings and writing the biography of him, what do you do in your life?
Whatever job I could get that'll pay the bills, that'll support me so that I could continue doing this on the side.
Well, okay, so what kinds of jobs? What are your skills? What are you trained as?
Let's see. I've been a radio DJ. I've been a newspaper reporter. I've been a cop. I've been a private detective.
You've been a cop? Okay.
I've been all kinds of different salesmen.
I am kind of curious. I mean, what was either the scariest or funniest or weirdest thing that ever happened to you when you were a policeman?
Uh-oh.
What?
Which one?
Oh, okay, yeah.
One with this, there's so many.
Pick two.
I wasn't ready for that one.
Okay, well, yeah, I like to throw a curveball now and then, so.
Yeah. A funny cop story. What's a good one? My daughter often will ask me to tell her a cop story, and I have to rack my brain to think of one that's.
Were you ever shot or shot at?
That's the most common question. Yeah, shot at many, many times.
Many, many times. Good Lord.
Yeah, it's quite common to get shot at. Nightclubs would let out. People would take pot shots in the crowd, and then you'd see a car drive away. So that was the most obvious answer. And you'd go after the car, and that's the guy with the gun. And so after doing that a number of times, I was in a court case against one of those situations, and the defense attorney said, how can he say that, he heard the gunshot come from there, and the judge said, look, I've had Officer Goodman testify in these cases so many times, I'll accept his testimony as an expert witness for how to determine the direction a gunshot came from just by sound alone.
Nice.
So,
because that's a very difficult, you with echo effects and everything around it, it's virtually impossible unless you've been shot at many, many times.
Yeah, basically.
But you never got hurt.
Not shot.
Oh, wait, well, okay. Did you ever get stabbed?
There were plenty of times that I just took weapons away from people, whether they were knives or guns. Just walk right up to them and take it away.
So how long were you a policeman?
5 years.
And you burned out, or why did you stop?
Well, I burned out kind of the way, what's his name, the guy that they can't find, Jimmy Hoffa. I founded a local chapter of a police officers union, and that was good for all the other officers other than me, basically.
Oh, I gotcha. And then were you a private eye before or after?
Yeah, after. That's like the first thing that ex-cops do. They go do that, and then get tired of chasing the cheaters who are cheating on cheaters. Pretty much what that business seems to be limited to these days.
What are recent jobs that you've done? What are current activities? Again, besides the creative work.
Well, that's the whole thing. I've always got to find something that I can interject my Dickie Goodman style. As a radio DJ, I play the Dickie Goodman records as soon as I could get away with it during a show.
Well, are you on the radio now? I mean, I don't mean on my show. I mean, are you on a station now?
No.
Oh, okay. Just wondering. Anyway, we're talking with John Goodman, the son of Dickie Goodman. John Goodman has put together the compilation disc Long Live the King, featuring more than 24 cuts of the famous break-in and mashup songs that his dad really helped pioneer. Kind of wondering then, though, when things really, really went downhill for your dad. Did you have an inclination that he would do what he did?
Well, at the time I did, yeah. Really, after Hey-T, he really only had like one other record in the 80s. That was a tough break, and then it got to the point where then the industry was changing from vinyl to CD. You also had the beginning of this conglomeration effect of labels being gobbled up by major companies and radio stations being gobbled up by conglomerates, and so he was losing this ability to draw on smaller labels that he knew and the DJs that normally he would turn to play his records were no longer in charge. Now there were program directors who had to get permission from executives higher up, and there's a major change in radio where the stations became specialized. Instead of having so many stations that would play the hits, have a station that would only play adult contemporary or would only play this or only play that, and that was their format, so there were less places to be heard. So he was going through a tough time that he didn't know if he could have hung in there, that things would have gotten a lot easier eventually for him.
I mean, he may not have made a whole hell of a lot more money, but he would have had creative outlets that would have been really cheap for him.
Everybody's on iTunes.
Right.
So,
And YouTube and places like that.
Exactly, and that is a good thing. It helps perpetuate his legacy even, because I always find it very refreshing to come across something on YouTube where kids have made a Dickie Goodman-style video and say it, acknowledge it, say this, you know, and how do they even know? Dickie Goodman-style record. And then that's the other catch, too. A music video would have been nearly impossible for him in his era, and now people can take
splice
records and edit on their own home computers and set it perfectly to whatever movie it was based on or anything like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. And, you know, it hadn't even occurred to me until I heard you in another interview say, oh, yeah, he could have done mashup break-in videos, sample videos. And I was like, oh, God, of course he could have and would have. It's funny, I took you saying it for me to even think of that. But and not to dwell on the bad stuff, because we're going to leave that really quickly, but how long did it take? I mean, it will take you forever to fully get over it, but how long did it take you to get through your father's suicide?
I was young, so I didn't know what to do about his music business at that point. And it took me a few years to sort of figure out or have the ideas come to me on what I should be doing to perpetuate his legacy, really. And that was probably a great bit of healing, if you will, for his loss, because I was able to get his stuff out there and share it with the world on the latest forms of media, whether it was CD and then later with the digital downloads and so on.
Was it healing to write the biography book that you wrote about him?
Yeah, I wrote that book almost with a vengeance, because part of that was I was coming across at the time so many things that he did that were just astounding and not really getting any sort of official recognition for it. And so as I was writing the book, you know, that's when it was during the writing the book and so on, where to get him a Grammy for one of his records. It was during the writing the book that to get Billboard to go back and count the records again, because they had named Ray Stevens number one for the genre, and he had 14 hits, and by my count, there were 17. And all it took really was a phone call, and Billboard said, okay, yeah, he is number one. You know, then once Billboard made him number one, then I submitted that to the Guinness Book of World Records. So now he's up there with Elvis and the Beatles and other greats for what he did in his own category of comedy.
I did want to ask one question about the book. If you go on Amazon and you go to order it and you look at the reviews, there was this spate of really vicious negative reviews. And I'm wondering if there's something behind that, because it was just too, you know, the book sounds too good, you sound too intelligent for those reviews to be quite kosher, in a way. I mean, it almost sounds like somebody was after you back, you know, when the book came out.
Yeah. I mean, the real fans or the public are always very, very nice with this stuff. In the case of the book, you know, it's a self-published book by a guy who wrote a book about his dad, basically. So it, first of all, wouldn't really deserve any kind of seriously negative review. It's not like a major publisher, a major author with unlimited resources, you know. But at the time, I was a newspaper reporter, and the other reporters were familiar with that I had written a book, because that's like every writer's dream. Anyone who does writing for a living also dreams of writing the great novel. So they knew about that, and I came across a big local news story, and I was the one who got it, and, you know, went on the Associated Press. And so they're taking heat from the managers. Well, what are you guys doing? And just when I left the paper, they had the opportunity to go on there and just say some mean things, you know, this little grouping of phony negative reviews that you can't do anything about because it's all automated.
Right, you can't delete Amazon. You can have a YouTube channel and delete comments there that you don't like,
right.
But Amazon is its own thing.
Yeah, so unfortunately, you've got that there, and the one thing that's really made me feel a lot better about it is the kind of reviews that the new CD is getting, you know, official reviews, and they're good, and they talk about how the significance of it, they're raising him from just being called something from the pop subculture to, you know, real historical pop culture time capsules, or what his records are all about, really. And all the book did was put it all in chronological order, like almost like a book report. So if somebody says, well, yeah, you wrote too much about yourself in the book, my answer is, okay, which part about me should I have left out? Should I have left out the part about me where I was in the studio with Dickie Goodman as he was recording Mr. Jaws, his biggest hit ever, perhaps, and in order to make the sound of drowning by the shark, he dunked his head in a janitor's mop bucket. You know, how could you get that story from anyone other than the guy who is there seeing it happen, you know? So,
absolutely right. And it's almost like saying, I mean, I have not had the chance to read your book, but like if you read the Patti Smith book about Robert Mapplethorpe, well, it's, you leave Patti Smith out of the book, it becomes a very short and strange book. You know, she was there. She was part of it. And if it's filtered through her perspective, well, that's kind of the point. We have really one last question for John Goodman, and it is a perspective question. Do you have a favorite song? I'll call them songs, a favorite record that your dad did over all these. I mean, maybe it's Flying Saucer, maybe not. What would yours be?
I tend to change my mind here and there, because I do have a favorite of his from time to time. Like, I like what he did with Star Wars, where he, even though it wasn't really a hit, his Star Wars record where he made fun of the Force, you know, he would say, well, but wait, it's the Force, and he'd play something, and I just got a kick out of that, you know, that he keyed in on that, you know, that aspect, that sort of Zen aspect of Star Wars. Nobody was thinking about that, really, you know.
Okay.
They were just thinking about this, like, the first time anybody really paid attention to really great special effects in a sci-fi movie. So that was the thing, and what he keyed in on was the Force. Wait, it's the Force!
Star Wars by Dickie Goodman, and we're also going to thank John Goodman for being in the neighborhood to talk about his dad and his dad's work. Remember, you can get Long Live the King from Rock Beat Records. They have a website called rockbeatrecords.com. Also, Dickie Goodman, King of Novelty, the book. You can get that at Amazon and other places. And although John Goodman doesn't maintain like a website, he's all over social media. So if you go looking for him and trying to find out what he's up to, because you also put together another novelty record that wasn't just your dad's stuff a few years back. Was that for Rhino, or who was that for?
The beauty of things like iTunes or Amazon and all of these music download sites now is, for the first time ever, basically, I've got everything he's ever done is available. You know, a person could go to any of their favorite download sites at any given moment. All his stuff is available at one time. This particular CD, Long Live the King, Dickie Goodman, has the luxury of the guys at Rhino remastering his stuff for better sound quality for the first time ever. So it's great. You can get the CD to hold in your hand, or the digital download, however you'd like to do it.
We're very, very happy to have you with us digitally, John Goodman, and want to thank you so much for sharing your life, your father's story, and your story here in the neighborhood. It's been great.
Thank you.